Okay, thank you, and welcome everyone. As was mentioned, my name is Shin Zen, and today I get to do the thing I most like to do in the whole world, which is spend a day with people, talk about practice, and do practice. So that's going to be the rhythm of the day. We'll have practice periods, and then we will have a chance to talk about our experiences with the practice, both what's happening currently and maybe previous experiences that you've had. If you want to discuss that, we can do so. We'll also be talking about some basic issues, fundamental issues within the world contemplative traditions. In what ways do their experiences relate? In what ways are they different? And specifically within Buddhism, which we can think of Buddhism very broadly as consisting of, with an oversimplification, consisting of three major practice traditions associated with three historical periods in India and currently associated with three geographical regions of Asia. You have the Hinayana, the small vehicle, the Mahayana, the large vehicle, and the Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle, the three yanas, the three vehicles. We'll sort of be seeing if we can come up with an integrated paradigm that allows us to see those three vehicles as just different ways of going about the same endeavor, and more broadly, to see those three vehicles mounted in the larger framework of worldwide contemplative and mystical tradition. Now, that's a big intellectual load to carry, and we'll just sort of maybe touch lightly on it, but mostly we're going to do practice, but we will see if we can talk about those kinds of issues also a bit. For me, the integrating factor here is a way of viewing all contemplative practice worldwide. This is just my personal way of thinking about the issue based on both my academic training. I was originally trained to be a Buddhist scholar at the University of Wisconsin, but then I sort of got shunted into interest in practice and then interest in science and how science and world contemplative traditions can connect and so forth. So I never really finished my PhD, but effectively a PhD in Buddhist studies without the actual degree, all but dissertation. Instead of writing my dissertation, I spent 3 years meditating in a Shingon temple in Japan. And that was one of the smartest moves I made in my life. So anyway, that's sort of going to be the content of the day. The tenor of the rhythm of the day is going to be that it's mostly going to be practice and discussion about practice. And I'll guide the practice. I'm going to introduce you to a pretty broad way of doing mindfulness. We'll be working with any and all sensory experience. If you've only previously had experience working in something narrow like the breath, this might be a little bit of a stretch, literally and metaphorically, because we're going to work with whatever comes up. Worldwide, this kind of approach is sometimes called open presence or choiceless awareness, or you could say it's mindfulness where your focus range is the broadest possible range. Focus range is how broad or narrow you choose to focus when you're doing a meditation technique. And your focus range could be as narrow as the sensation of breath on the tip of your nose, or it could be mid-size, it could be your body, but just body, or it could be all experience. And we're going to start really broad with all experience. And as I say, sometimes if you've done the more shamatha kinds of contractive concentration, calming practices like the breath, it's like, wow, this doesn't feel like meditation. This is just like thinking. I'm having to keep track of all this sort of stuff. But that's just a little bit of a learning curve. With time, you sort of find that you can be in just as deep a state dealing with whatever comes up as you can with a narrow sort of maybe calming and contractive concentration practice. And in fact, this was one of the major innovations that Mahasi Sayadaw made. How many people have heard the name Mahasi Sayadaw? Very good. If you haven't, he was one of the major figures in 20th century Burmese mindfulness. He developed the Burmese Satipatthana method, as it's called. And his insight was something that in Pali is called Karnika Samadhi. It means momentary high concentration. Prior to that, the notion of concentration, as it had been practiced in a lot of Southeast Asia, was, okay, you focus on something very small and attempt to hold that for a long duration of time. Like, I can stay at the tip of my nose without any wavering for 4 hours, then you've achieved some level of, quote, shamatha, or stabilizing practice. What Mahasi pointed out is that there's another kind of samadhi that in Pali he called Karnika Samadhi. It's from the Sanskrit kshana, which means a moment. And it's to have a momentary high concentration with each sensory event as it arises without needing to restrict the awareness necessarily to something narrow. So that you could actually taste concentration on a sound and then an instant later on a mental image and then an instant later on a body sensation, even though your attention is moving very broadly, because each individual moment has a brief taste of samadhi, a samadhi rasa, is a brief taste of concentration there. It actually sums to the same deep state as if you had held your attention just at the tip of your nose for that period of time. However, just once again to give you the heads up, if you've never worked broadly like this, there may be a little bit of a learning curve. People sometimes say, well, I can't really go deep and at the same time stay broad like that. Yeah, at the beginning, it's a little bit like, rubbing your belly and patting your head, but then once you sort of get the idea, you got something that you can now do in daily life. You can drive to work and you see out, hear out, feel out. You see the sights of the road and it's momentary samadhi with each one. You hear the sounds of the road, same deal. You feel with your body the physical engagement with the car. You're driving completely safely and you're in a really, really deep state. That's sort of the payoff for being willing to go through what might be initially something that doesn't, quote, seem like meditation, because it's like, I'm having to think and pay attention to so many things, etc. So anyway, just a little introduction to what we'll be doing in terms of technique. I would claim that when you look at the contemplative technologies of the entire world, a couple things jump up, at least to me. One is that far and away, the most rigorous and systematic and thorough approach to the meditative endeavor is found in what tradition? What do you think I'm going to say? I would actually say Buddhism in general. Buddhism broadly. Yeah, that. there's that. Yeah, we're looking in the broadest part. Yeah. I would say worldwide. If you were to read Santa Teresa de Avila, St. Teresa of Avila, that's a 16th century Spanish mystic. If you were to read Isaac Luria, who lived about the same time but was in Palestine and was a Kabbalist, a Jewish mystic. If you read carefully and sensitively the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and if you read the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, written probably in the 6th century in Sri Lanka by Buddhaghosa, you can see that there's some really fundamental similarities here in the kinds of experiences that these people are reporting. And what's utterly extraordinary is that their worldviews and their cultures are very, very different. Yet there seems to be something universal going on here. For example, 16th century Roman Catholic Spain, Teresa of Avila. She's the only woman doctor of the church. That means she's the only, well, at one time, there may be others more now, but she was the first. The first woman that the Catholic Church said there's a certain area of Catholic doctrine where this person is the authority. This person has given you the best map, and they call that a doctor of the church. Well, what is Teresa the doctor of the church for? She is the highest authority for the stages on the contemplative path. Very interesting. And she divides it into seven stages. The first sort of deal with getting your act together as a human being, and those sort of roughly correspond to what in Buddhism we would call sila, the sort of ethics behavior component of things. Then she goes through and she shows a sequence of ever deepening states of calm and concentration. In the Catholic formulation, those are called states of recollection, meaning not to remember, but to collect yourself back in a concentrated state. And what is our generic term in Buddhism for that kind of thing, the most commonly used term? Bhavana means practice in general. Samadhi tends to be used in the state of concentration, to mean concentration in general. There's a lot of subtleties, but in general. And in general, the states of concentration are formulated in Buddhism in terms of four or eight or nine jhana levels. And you can see there's a very rough correspondence between the Buddhist jhanas and these progressive states of deeper concentration that Teresa reports. Now, mind you, this is someone living in the 16th century in Spain, completely Catholic Christian, doesn't even know Buddhism exists, probably. If she did, she would probably have thought it was the work of the devil. Yet, there's a parallel here. So then she talks about these seven stages, and then it's sort of like the Shila thing, and then you got the Samadhi thing. And then it culminates, well, penultimately, in something she calls arrobamiento in Spanish, which means rapture, which means she sits there for 3 days with waxy catatonia, not moving, which pretty much corresponds to the deeper formless jhanas that would affect your physiology and so forth. That's number six. And sure enough, late in life, she comes to something else, something completely different. And you can see her struggling to convey the difference. Essentially, she says, all this time, I thought this whole thing was about going into these deeper and deeper and deeper states of focus and withdrawal. But then this other thing happened to me. And now it doesn't make any difference whether I'm in some altered state or not. Something changed in my understanding. And now, and this is a direct quote, the self-forgetting is so profound that it seems as though the soul no longer exists. Now that might as well be lifted right out of Buddhism. That's no self. That's anatta, independently discovered. And not only did she not get in trouble with the Inquisition for having said that, but that became standard Catholic doctrine, believe it or not, even in the age of intolerance, European age of intolerance. The merging of God and the soul is that of water in water. Another quote. Well, that's lifted right out of the Hindu paradigm for enlightenment. When I discovered this, it was like, oh my God, this stuff that I thought was only in Buddhism, it's all over the world. But the clearest and most systematic formulation is absolutely within Buddhism. And by the way, the way I discovered this was sort of cool. So I'm at a retreat in Japan. It's a Zen retreat. And this was back in the day when there weren't that many foreigners that would be you would be seeing even in Japan in general, and certainly at a Zen retreat. So I'm sitting there, and I notice there's this other foreigner comes in. And he's not just a foreigner. He's like a Roman Catholic priest. He's got like a Roman collar. He's got like red hair. He's Irish, actually. Father William Johnston. Anybody ever read his books? Just curious. One of them is called Christian Zen. It's a classic. Anyway, so I'm thinking, wow, there's another gaijin here. There's another foreigner here. And this poor guy doesn't know what he's getting into. Right, because those Japanese Zen retreats are a little bit of a cross between a samurai boot camp and samurai torture chamber, if you've ever done Zen in the Japanese context. Anyway, just be glad we're doing mindfulness, okay? But anyway, so I'm thinking, this poor guy doesn't know what he's got. He's a Catholic priest. He doesn't know what he's getting into, you know, and he got like sits down. It's like perfect lotus posture, like bang, samadhi. I mean, you can tell by the way someone sits. I said, oh my God, the guy sits like a Zen monk. He's like, so at the break, I went up and introduced myself and we became friends. And I found out he's a Jesuit. He's like a two-way missionary. On one hand, yeah, he's interested in spreading Christianity in Japan, but on the other hand, he's interested in spreading Buddhist techniques in the Catholic world. And indeed he did. Everywhere he went, traveled all over the place. Everywhere he went, when he would leave, Zafus would remain. And he had a major influence in bringing the systematic approaches of Buddhism into the Christian contemplative world. Just amazing. So he used to let me, he traveled a lot, so if I stayed in Tokyo, he'd let me stay in his room. And everyone thought I was a Jesuit. And he had this library on contemplative, world contemplative traditions, everything. And so I started to graze there, and I realized, wow, it's not just in Buddhism. There's things like this all over the world, including in my own tradition of birth, Judaism. There's words in Hebrew, there's technical terms in Hebrew that actually correspond to technical terms in Sanskrit and Pali. It's like, oh my God, what an eye-opener that was. So that just, that gave me this big picture of a sort of integrated paradigm. Later in life, when I started to study science, I started to think the way scientists think about things, which is typically, can we analyze complex systems into more simple components? So the paradigm, which is to say the basic model that I like to use in viewing world contemplative practice in an integrated perspective, and therefore automatically viewing Buddhist practice within an integrated perspective, is that the three core skills that I see that are at least one and hopefully all three are present in any contemplative tradition. In my personal vocabulary, I call concentration power, sensory clarity, and equanimity. So not all contemplative traditions emphasize all three or cultivate all three systematically. However, it is the salient feature of the original Buddha, the original Buddha's teaching. He had all three of these elements integrated together. So we know what concentration power is. We can think of it as the ability to focus on what we deem relevant, which could be broad or narrow. Sensory clarity we can think of as the ability to untangle the strands of sensory experience, to know what part is visual? What part is auditory? What part is somatic? What part is inner, related to thoughts and emotions? What part is outer, related to the physical senses? Is a sensory experience stable, or is it flowing? Can we detect the beginnings or the ends? Okay. All of these, how intense is the sensory experience? Where is it located? What's its size, its shape? How much of what, when, and where, interacting in what ways and changing at what rates? This kind of quantification, these are dimensions with regards to which we can be clear about what we're experiencing moment by moment. That's the sensory clarity component. The word vipassana, vi means separate, and passana means to see. So to see separately, to untangle the sensory strands and substrands. That's one meaning of the word vipassana. There are others. Okay, it's concentration power. All meditative traditions have this. Sensory clarity, very systematic and very central in early Buddhism. The basic idea, untangle and be free. If you can see that there's just the five skandhas, the five aggregates, you'll see there's no self there. How many people have ever heard this doctrine? It's central to early Buddhism. So that's your sensory clarity piece. Equanimity is just another way of saying sensory detachment, the ability to allow sensory experience to come and go without push and pull. So equanimity is the opposite of raga and dvesha. Raga is the clinging, typically around pleasure. Dvesha is the pushing away and aversion, typically around uncomfortable experiences. So when I say equanimity, it's just another way of saying what the Buddha would have called detachment or letting go or not having cravings and aversions, etc. But I sort of like the cover term equanimity, which means to take a balanced attitude, not pushing and pulling on the natural flow of the senses. The equanimity piece is central to early Buddhism. It's basically the Buddha's reworking of the asceticism that he had originally practiced in a proto-Jain community, where the paradigm was the more it hurts and you endure it, the more you will purify consciousness. It is often said that the Buddha rejected asceticism. I don't like that languaging. I don't think he rejected asceticism. Asceticism is exposing yourself to discomfort or depriving yourself of pleasures for some sort of spiritual goal. That's asceticism. It is usually said in every textbook that the Buddha rejected asceticism. I don't think he rejected asceticism. I think he refined asceticism into the middle way, where the paradigm is not, okay, it's not so much how much you're enduring or how much you give up. It's your moment-by-moment attitude of how much equanimity you can bring to the sensory experience of the moment. And you could have a moderate lifestyle and still deeply purify consciousness. You don't have to do extreme fasting or self-torture, etc., as was pretty traditional in pre-Buddhist India for a number of centuries. So equanimity is sort of a reworking of the ascetical tradition. Now, ascetical tradition exists in Christianity. We still have remnants of that in our language. Can anybody think of some expressions? They're not used often, but there are some expressions in English that are remnants of Christian ascetical practices. Huh? Well, the custom of Lent, absolutely, is that. I was thinking of some... Well, there's some other idioms. Wear a hair shirt, meaning to sort of dump on yourself. That is still done a little bit. They would wear these like very coarse garments that irritated you all the time. And then by accepting that, you sort of purified away some of the sinfulness. Yes?
Hitting your head against the wall.
I don't think that one, but self... Maybe that's a Jewish one. The Christian one is self-flagellation. Someone got it. Like, and that's absolutely done. If you want to see a really amazing movie, just totally amazing movies, it's one of these sleepers that no one knows about with Raul Julia, and it's called The Penitent. Anybody ever see this movie? This movie is amazing. It's about los penitentes. Los penitentes, even though it sounds like something in Mexico, it's actually in New Mexico. It's in the United States. It's a Catholic group where every Easter, someone gets chosen to be El Cristo. I think you may see where this is going. No, they don't kill him, okay? They just come damn close. They physically crucify, but they actually drive the nails through. And then there's all sorts of, but then the other ones that weren't chosen also have to go through horrible flagellations and all sorts of other horrible stuff. Now, I know it's like maybe this is already getting squirmy and you're like, but when you see the movie, this is what makes this movie so unusual. When you see the movie, you will get the point, actually. You will get the point. And it's interesting that this tends to be done among people that have maybe some Indian blood. And of course, this is none other than the Sundance and the whole, all those shamanic things that our remote ancestors did and do, just put into a Catholic form. So that's the ascetical theology of Christianity. It was there. But I would say that the Buddhist formulation is vastly more subtle, both in terms of implementation. You don't necessarily have to almost die. It's the middle way, right? You've probably studied this. But also in terms, maybe even more importantly, in terms of conceptual formulation. It's like, it's the amount of openness that you bring to the experience, not the intensity of the experience alone, that determines the degree to which the kleshas or impurities, the sankskaras, the sankharas get broken up. So that's the equanimity component. And I would claim that you can look worldwide across all contemplative traditions and see the ways in which they either do or do not systematically develop these. And then you can look within the Buddhist tradition of the three vehicles, and you can sort of do a meta-analysis. If you sort of look beyond the doctrines and the historical trappings, you can sort of see, you know what, each one of them develops each of these three in its own way. And so that gives a sort of integrated paradigm. So we're going to explore one way to develop these skills. And we're gonna call it see, hear, feel, not surprisingly. So you can see it's gonna be very tangible. So the instruction set for this technique is very simple. Whenever you're aware of something visual, I should say, we're going to have the option to do this with mental labels or without labels, but we're gonna start with mental labels. How many of you are familiar with the term in English to note, N-O-T-E, sensory experience? I would suspect most of you are. So label is something that can help you note. Noting a sensory event means to clearly acknowledge its presence and then briefly focus on it for a second. That's that karnika samadhi, or moment of concentration. What will help you acknowledge is it, help you acknowledge, not required but can be helpful, is to use a mental label to name the sensory experience. You sort of name the target and then you briefly focus on it. So if you're aware of any visual experience, say to yourself, see, and then briefly focus on that visual experience unless it immediately vanishes, in which case you'll only have the time to acknowledge it. You won't have time to focus on it because it evaporated. If you're aware of any auditory experience, then say to yourself, hear, and briefly focus on that auditory experience, once again, unless it immediately vanishes. If you're aware of any somatic, that is to say body experience, say feel, briefly focus on that body experience. That's it. That's the end of the instructions. However, the instructions are incomplete as stated. So now I like to receive your questions, but I also like to ask questions. I like to force you to think and maybe take a chance. The instruction set I gave you was incomplete because it doesn't cover certain contingencies, certain possibilities. So what would be some questions that weren't covered by those instructions? What might be some possibilities in you? Might not be sure what to do based on just what I just told you. Yeah.
When you say feel, are you talking of feeling the physical sensation, or are you talking of the feeling as the emotion, as in the emotion?
Okay, excellent. So one thing that was not, see, I did this on purpose. I gave ambiguous, incomplete instruction because I want you to discover where the ambiguities and the incompletenesses are. That was one of the ambiguities. I just said any visual experience. I didn't give you a list. I didn't class, likewise, auditory or somatic. So you say, hey, what do you mean? You mean just the touch of my clothes, or do you mean if I have anger, fear, sadness? What do you mean by feel? So that's one of the things I hope people would spot. So now we're going to answer those questions. Any is a very big word. So let's begin with visual experience. What would be some things that would constitute visual experiences? You could have the mental image of a memory, or more broadly, you could have a mental image of a plan or a fantasy. So a little more broadly, one form of visual experience is visual thoughts, which are usually called mental images. That counts. Because I said any visual experience. What else could be a visual experience? You're going to say da or something. Sure, physical sights. I see the zafu, I see the leaf. So we'll call mental, we're going to have a jargon if you don't have to learn it, but mental images, just for short, we could call it CN. It's a kind of inner seeing. Physical sights, see out. Those all count. Here's some other things. If your eyes are closed, well, you might have images, but you might not. But what you might see is sort of dark or bright, which is sort of restful. Those turn into what are called kasinas, K-A-S-I-N-A. I'm giving you a lot of technical Buddhist terms. You don't have to memorize them all. It's all on the internet. Look at Wikipedia if you're interested. But I just want to show that we are in the Buddhist tradition, even though my formulation is very secular and non-Buddhist culturally. But you could look at the dark, bright, in front of, behind your closed eyes. That's a visual rest experience. That's a sea rest. And traditionally, those become jhana kasina exercises if they get intense enough. So those would be, so you could, and then you might be aware, like your whole visual field might sometimes break up into undulations, vibration, pixelation. Anyone ever had something like that happen? That would be a sea flow. You'd be seeing anicca, impermanence, energy, chi. So there's a broad range of things that could count as sea. What are some things we could hear? I'm going to give you a hint. It's the same broad categories, okay? In, out, rest, flow. Absolutely. You could hear in, you could hear mental talk, you could hear out physical sounds. You could be aware of silence and grok on the silence. You could hear noble silence as an absence of mental talk, maybe. Or anybody ever sort of get a kind of undercurrent of sort of vibratory energy in, you know, their ears, whatever? You're hearing flow. You're hearing anicca. You're hearing impermanence. You're hearing chi. Analogously with the body, physical type sensations, touch of the air, touch of the clothes, emotional sensations, something touches your heart. They're all in the body, but like you say, one's more emotional, one's more physical. How many people ever had like an energy flow in the body? Okay, yeah, well, you're feeling flow. Or just sitting, you're just aware of being physically relaxed into the posture, which I encourage you to do over and over again. You stretch up, you settle in, just sit. What's the first thing you experience the instant you sit down? Physical relaxation into the posture. That's a somatic rest flavor. That's a feel rest. So, any of the above count as C. So, excellent, you disambiguated as per a good Wikipedia page. That was part of the incompleteness, the ambiguity. There's some other incompletenesses in the instruction set I gave. If you're aware of something visual, say see. If you're aware of something auditory, hear. If you're aware of something somatic, feel. What's missing? I see maybe Paula, yes. Excellent. Excellent. What do you do? That's a subtle one. I would say that it is highly possible if you say, hey, nothing much is happening, that actually you still are seeing or hearing, or let's just put it this way, visual, auditory, or somatic experience is probably still available. However, it's in the form of a restful state. If nothing much seems to be happening, three things actually are happening. Your mental screen is blank, your head is quiet, and your body is emotionally relaxed and neutral. So actually you're seeing rest, hearing rest, and feeling rest. So see, in my system technically, in terms of Buddhism, would be called shamatha vipassana yuganatta. You will all memorize this phrase, right? Well, maybe you can, because shamatha means calming, vipassana means clarifying, and yuganatta means practice together. So I weave the restful states with the active states. So it is likely if you sort of think, hey, nothing much is happening, probably your mental screen is blank, and if your eyes are closed, you're seeing darkness or brightness. Guess what? That's visual. That's a C rest. You can note that as C. You can learn, it's like artists training for negative space. You learn how to hear the spaces, feel the spaces, see the spaces. It's another dimension of clarity. So that was an excellent point. Most likely, if you're thinking, oh, nothing's happening, what you're really thinking is, none of the ordinary activations like sound or physical sensations are happening. But silence may be happening, probably is happening. Physical relaxation is happening. You can tune into those restful states and note those in terms of their three sensory modalities, see, hear, feel. Okay, so that was a good one, and there's one more. It's sort of apropos, I think someone's got it.
What about reminiscence and projection?
Okay. So when you're having memory, this is excellent, very good point. When you're having a memory, you'll probably get some vague visual impression of that memory scene. You may remember the dialogue. You may have some emotional reaction to that in your body. You're seeing, hearing, and feeling the memory. Analogously for planning and fantasizing. We don't call it imagination for nothing, it's images, right? So those are specific categories. Will and desire, well, you're sitting here and it's like, oh my God, would I like an ice cream cone? You've got the mental image of the ice cream cone, I'll bet. I just told you, you've got the, oh my God, would I like that in talk space, in your head, in your ears, and you've got the smiliness on the face and the rosiness in the chest. It's see, hear, feel. You call it will and desire, but it's actually something you tangibly see, hear, feel. Therefore, you can note it in terms of its sensory modalities. Great point. There's one more. Yes?
Consciousness
itself raises a very interesting discussion, which maybe we could table to the afternoon. That's going to take us into an interesting but a little bit of a sidelight. But we won't argue about what consciousness is. However, we will claim that you can track it in terms of three basic flavors, see, hear, feel. Oh, by the way, well, this was another one I didn't mention. It's a little artificial, but for simplicity, we're going to consider smell and taste to be body, just to have a simple symmetry of things. So what wasn't mentioned, what contingency, what possibility is jumping out that has not been addressed? Oh, now that's great. That's also something. Okay, so sometimes, wasn't what I was thinking, but I should have mentioned it, so thanks. You might have rapid-fire events. You might have mental images that just come way too fast for you to possibly label each one. In that case, you can do what I call averaging. You just take an average, okay? It's like, okay, in the last 5 seconds, I had 15 mental images, but I'm just going to say C. And I know that that's just an abbreviation for I just saw 15 individual images. So you can just, the pace of your labeling doesn't have to be perfectly correlated with the pace of what you're noticing, which may happen much more rapidly than you can label. So you have the option of what I call averaging. It's just, you just say C, even though it's a whole bunch of events that were visual. Excellent. I guess there was a lot of points I didn't mention, and you guys are getting them. Common question. Hey, if I'm making a mental label, that's obviously an auditory event. That's mental talk. Should I label the label? Answer, what do you think? No, not unless you want a frustrating infinite regress. Well, consider the labels to be sort of a scaffolding that are in their own category. The scaffolding is where you stand in order to see the building. The building is all the rest of sensory experience, both the inner experience of self as inner see, hear, feel, and the outer experience of surrounding scene as the physical senses. That's the building. The labels are scaffolding. We don't drive ourselves crazy labeling the label. Excellent point. Yes? Well, a deactivation is probably going to be a rest. If by deactivation you mean an absence of mental image or mental talk. Huh? Ah, excellent point. The endings of things and the beginnings of things are, in my formulation of mindfulness, extremely important. Because actually the moment is in the beginning and in the ending. Now you might say, well, what about the duration? But if you break the duration down, it itself is made up of little beginnings and endings. I think you see where this is going. So you don't need to, for now, explicitly have a label for that. But it is good if you can catch things at the very instant of arising or notice the instant of passing. Those of you familiar with my system know it's an option. You don't have to worry about it for now, but some people like to explicitly label the moment of vanishing. If you wish to, you can, but you absolutely don't have to. And the label is gone. That's the word I use for that. You can go on the internet and read my essay, or you might have read it in Tricycle, called The Power of Gone. I talk about that a little bit. But for now, most people, you're not familiar with my system. You don't have to worry about like catching the gones, unless you really want to. Okay, well, let's see. Yes?
So, what about if a particular one of the three is more predominant? So you have a feeling that keeps recurring, you still want to...
Okay, excellent, excellent. You folks are catching everything. We're going to start with a passive stance, meaning you just let sensory experiences come to you or call you. And if nothing much seems to come or call, then restful states are coming and calling, okay? Meaning if you're pulled to the same goddamn thing over and over again, then just let that happen. We're going to start with a passive stance. More active contact stances, where you systematically sweep through things or attempt to hold a certain thing, are certainly legitimate focus stances, but we're going to start with a passive. So that means you may well be pulled to the same goddamn thing over and over again. Does not matter, because our interest is in that moment of concentration. And if you have a quality moment, even if it's with the same pain over and over again, the magic is in the moment. So if you just, in the moment, each time you're pulled to that dominant thing, you just try to have a moment of concentration, clarity, and equanimity with it, then that's all that's required. That is, on your part, an excellent insight. If you go on the internet and put in Shinzen Yang pain processing algorithm, you'll find some articles I've written. Okay? Algorithm is just a fancy word for a systematic procedure. And I have a systematic procedure for dealing with pain. And one of the important features of that procedure is the insight that you just gave voice to, which is to realize sensorially, when you have a pain issue, a physical pain issue, there are actually four sensory components involved. You've got the physical pain itself, and that has two subcomponents, the local intensity and the global spread. Then you have the mental image associated with the pain, you have the mental talk that may be associated with the pain, and you have emotional body reactions that are qualitatively distinct from the pain itself. Remember the original Buddhist insight, divide and conquer, untangle and be free. If you've got 10 units of discomfort in the pain itself, 10 units of disconcerting mental image, 10 units of negative talk, and 10 units of uncomfortable emotion, by what mathematical formula do we calculate your aggregate suffering? Well, I would claim, roughly speaking, that the answer to that question depends. It depends on how well you're able to separate those variables. If you're able to be with exactly what's there, you've got 10 plus 10 plus 10 plus 10. How much is that? 4 times 10 equals? If you're unable to separate the variables, which most people aren't because they haven't been trained in vipassana, untangling, mind clarity skills, if you're unable to separate, what tends to happen is that they cross-multiply, creating 10 times 10 times 10 times 10. That is 10 to the fourth power, which equals? 10,000 was the correct answer. Well, that's right? 100 times 100, etc. Okay. So what's really happening, when the person says, I'm at 10,000, what's really happening is, really, really happening is that you're at 40. But yet, so... you can read the algorithm and it will show you that you can work with the individual parts to separate them out. Do just the see, just the hear, just the feel, etc. And then you can work with the aggregate. Work with the whole, work with the parts until you go from multiplicative overwhelm to additive manageability. And that's the miracle of mindfulness. That's an explanatory mechanism, a quantified explanatory model for why mindfulness is now so popular in pain management clinics and so forth. Good insight. Okay, well, here's what I didn't mention. I'll give you one more chance.
It's what happens if you, hear a bus and you see them?
Absolutely, you got it. You got it, that was it. Co-occurrences. It is easily happen that you can have a visual and auditory experience at the same time. Perfect example that you mentioned. You hear this an external sound, and at the same time you see a mental image. So now you're actually having a see-hear experience. So for starters, to keep things simple, we're going to say, in that case, you take the active role to just choose one to name and focus on. So we only have to use three labels for starters. You could go inclusive, but then you're going to have the possibility of seven labels. See here, see feel, hear feel, all, you know. That's a possibility, but we're going to start by saying, okay, in the instance that more than one occurs at the same time, you're going to actively just choose one to focus on. It doesn't matter which. And by the one, I mean one of the modalities. So, okay, good. In less than an hour, we have now, as far as I know, covered all the possibilities for the instruction set. And we've also given you a unified view of world contemplative skills that applies not only to the three vehicles, but also to Christian, Jewish, Islamic, even Native American psycho-spiritual practices. So I think we're pretty good as far as technique goes. When we come back from this break period, we're going to start to actually implement this. Just a process comment. There's a lot of us, which is the good news, and there's only two washrooms, which is the bad news. So what I'm going to say is that during practice periods and during discussion periods, feel free to use the washrooms so that we don't get this horrific crush during the breaks. Just try to really be silent about it, you know, and so forth. And that, I think that's what we're going to do logistically. So what we're going to do now is take a little stretch break, and we won't be in silence yet. You can use the washrooms, you can get some liquid, you can talk to each other. I'm going to ask how many people in this room are trained to teach my system? And Paula, you're one of them. Everyone that raised their hand, stand up, please. And give a little introduction to yourself. These are the people that you can be free to go to for any questions in addition to me.
I'm Paula England, and I live in New York City, and I've been going to church and retreats for about 20 years.
I'm Raquel Shapiro. I live here in New York also, and I'm trained in Shenzhen system and generally teach with the Dharma community.
My name is Yanosh, same general situation. And I guess the only thing to add is that we teach on Wednesday nights, so if people are lost and need to find some information, but
The other thing I would say is everything you will hear me say exists free on the internet in terms of articles on my websites and segments on my YouTube channels. So there's nothing there's no fluff in the way I teach, okay? My hobby is math. And it's just, okay, if you've ever read an upper division textbook in math, it's like, okay, definition, definition, theorem, theorem, lemma, corollary, corollary, at which point you go, if you're mathematically sophisticated, oh my God, okay. Well, for better or worse, that's the way I teach, okay? There's no fluff, it's all just dense and significant information. So, that may be the bad news, because most people aren't really into reading upper division math texts. The good news is every syllable has been recorded in articles and on the internet, and it's all scot-free. So you just click on these things, and if you want to, remember what I said, it's the internet has remembered for you. So we're going to take a stretch break. I'm industrial strength, but I'm user-friendly, so feel free to come up and talk and whatever. And you can talk to Raquel, you can talk to Janusz and Paula also. take a moment to stretch up and settle in. The face goes smooth. The jaw drops. The shoulders fall. The arms are limp and loose. The legs are happy not to have to work. The anti-gravity muscles are relaxed. And in the core, on each out-breath from beginning to end, the intercostal muscles and the diaphragm muscle automatically relax. This posture is born in between heaven and earth. The spine expands up like a tree, trying to touch Father Sky. And from that central pillar, the whole body hangs limp and loose, surrendering to the contractive force of Mother Earth. Relaxing. This posture alone is an entire path. Links us directly to the yang and yin, the fundamental forces of nature. We'll start with eyes closed. When you're aware of a visual event, see and briefly focus on it. Likewise hear, likewise feel. If two or all three come or call at the same time, just choose one. Remember, it could be a mental image, or it could just be the darkness, brightness, or some color, or some swirling energy that you see. Sound could be mental, it could be physical sound, or you could have mental talk, or an awareness of auditory rest, quiet, silence, or a flow of energy in auditory. The body could be just physical relaxation. You feel that. Or it could be the physical touches or emotional sensations or a flow of energy that you feel. Smell and taste usually don't arise in the Zendo, but they could. We'll put those under feel just to simplify things. You experience them in the nose, the mouth, and so forth, its body in a certain way. And that's it. The magic here is in the moment, that moment of brief concentration. If you're pulled to the same thing over and over again, that's fine. If your attention moves very broadly, that's fine. Remember that if you're thinking, it could involve mental image, mental talk, or both. So these are things you see, you hear. If you're going through emotions, could involve those. But it could involve emotional sensations. It's all good. We're going to take a passive stance. Let things come or call. The only place where we would take an active stance is if two or all three come or call at the same time, then just choose one to label and focus on. And that's it. remember that if you're thinking, it could involve something you see, a mental image. Often images are sort of fleeting and ill-defined, but they are visual. It could involve something you hear, self-talk, or someone else's voice, a conversation, a monologue, a dialogue, a snippet of a sentence, but you hear it in talk space, in your head, at your ears. If anything is emotional is going on, anger, fear, sadness, impatience, embarrassments, disgust, interest, joy, love, gratitude, humor, smile, that's going to be something you feel, at least, in the body. The ordinary ordering principle for the mind is get answers and avoid confusion. The new ordering principle is be clear sensorially and remain open. Let images come and go without an investment to extract meaning. Let mental talk come and go without an investment to extract meaning. This is a deeper organizing principle for the mind. The ordinary ordering principle for the body. The body says, I'm ordered if I can get comfort and avoid discomfort. Nothing wrong with that principle, but we're here to learn a different principle, an independent dimension, a dimension independent of conditions. The new ordering principle, it's the same for the mind. Get sensorially clear. Know when body arises, perhaps when body passes. Sensorially. And remain sensorially open. Greet pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Greet subtle, medium, or intense, the same way. Same greeting, equanimity, balanced attitude. Letting pleasure, plain, or neutrality, physical and or emotional, come and go without push and pull. That's to remain open. Over and over again, we get pulled into the ordinary ordering principle, which is our habit. I need to figure this out. I can't just abide with don't know. I need to get comfortable, physical or emotional comfort. I can't just abide with discomfort. I need to have pleasure. I can't just abide with neutral. The new ordering principle, we find eventually everything we need in the clarity, the openness, which is equanimity, and in the concentration, which has its own reward. In other words, our new ordering principle that we're gradually learning is, regardless of whether the mind has answers or is confused, regardless of whether the body is in pleasant, unpleasant, there's another dimension to our okayness. One over which ultimately we have control. a dimension independent of conditions, independent of the content of experience. Hence the word moksha, liberation, which in this particular approach comes not from escaping away, but from escaping into the senses. Now we're going to make a slight change, which will impact visual experience. I would like you to just slightly open your eyes, just sort of let a little light in. You don't have to completely open them, just it can be a tiny crack or sort of to half-mast, anything in between. That's going to bring some brightness. Some color and form might also arise depending on how wide the aperture. If it's just brightness, well, that's something you see. If it creates pixelation and energy patterns, well, that's something you see also. You see flow. If color and form of the physical world arise, that's something you see. So not quite eyes open, but eyes at least a little bit open. But still broadly floating, whatever comes or calls, inner or outer, active or restful, stable or flowing. Just parse it into a visual target, an auditory target, or a somatic target, and then focus awareness on that target for just a moment. Now we're going to up the ante considerably in terms of C. I would like you to open your eyes all the way. This is going to bring external sight online. That's fine. You'll be pulled to this, you'll be pulled to that. Just briefly focus on whatever visual arises. However, the two other modalities are still online. There's the physicality of the body. And there's possible inner reactions to the outer sights. Mental image, mental talk. Emotional body, if you're a little less comfortable emotionally with your eyes open, then that's something you feel. That's okay. So there's the obvious impact that now external sights are included. There's perhaps the more subtle impact that this activates or deactivates the inner system, the inner see, hear, feel. You'll discover that those inner reactions to outer sights are part of the mechanism that creates the sense of having an observer. And the inner reactions to external sounds and the inner reactions to the physicality of the body work in the same way. However, regardless of how complex or what the valence is, in terms of basic modalities, we're still only seeing only hearing, only feeling. And that's all we have to track. Now continue to do exactly the same technique. But if you wish, it's not absolutely required, but if you wish, slowly stand in place. And you can even move around a little bit if you want. But keep the noting, and in this case, the labeling going as you do that. Or some of you may wish to just sit through. Sometimes people sit for hours without getting up. It's all good. But this isn't a break at all. It's merely a shift in posture. The focus procedure is unchanged. You can stand with your eyes closed or open as you wish. Or just sit. Whatever appeals to you. And for seated, once again, eyes open or closed as you wish. If you're standing and find it useful to move around a bit, that's fine, but it doesn't mean that the technique evaporates. You're just doing practice in motion, simple stretches, whatever appeals to you. Now, if you have a really good momentum of concentration, clarity, and equanimity, then you can drop the mental labels and just note with direct awareness. But very often, that will lead to getting spaced out and getting caught up in things. So then you go back to the mental labels, if need be. The labels are an option in the noting process. The noting process is that rhythm, acknowledge, focus, acknowledge, focus. The labels help you acknowledge the sensory modality. But if you can have that clarity and that rhythm going without the labels, then fine. But if you start to get spaced out or caught up in content, then go back to the labels. It's all good. It's like gears in a car. First gear is for hills, cruise control is when everything's just sailing along. So the mental labels, or spoken labels even, they're like first gear. And direct awareness without labels, maybe cruise control, or third gear. If you hit a hill, you don't hesitate to go into first gear. Our focus range is everything, inner or outer, active or restful, stable or flowing. Our focus apparatus is to be clear about which modality we're focusing in, to be open to whatever comes up, and to have that brief moment of tasting concentration on each event, unless, of course, it evaporates too quickly, in which case there's only the acknowledging. But that's okay, because there's insight into impermanence, the goneness of things. Sooner or later, will and desire arise. What part is a mental picture of the thing desired? What part is a mental comment about the need thereof? What part involves pleasant or unpleasant physical or emotional sensations in the body? As a sensory event, will, desire, need, urge, they're tangible sensory arisings involving inner see, inner hear, and perhaps some combination of inner and outer feel. They can be deconstructed, experienced so fully that they don't coagulate into a thing anymore. The bars of the cell open so wide, separate so fully that you can just walk out. You're no longer imprisoned in the mind and body. A lofty goal, Arya Pariyesana, the noble quest. We take it one step at a time. The next 5 minutes represent one of those steps. In a moment, the bell will ring to signal the transition from formal practice to life practice. It's possible, as the result of this period of practice, that you're currently experiencing some increase in tranquility, energy, emotional well-being. If so, tune into that. It's possible that you may be able to taste qualities of concentration, sensory clarity, and equanimity. If so, that taste does not have to evaporate simply because we move from formal practice to ordinary life. The most important moment in any period of formal practice is, in fact, the transition from formal practice to ordinary life. The extent to which we ride on the momentum of the effect of the formal practice is the extent to which the practice informs our life. Okay, good. Good work, folks. So if you want to move around a bit, make yourself comfortable, feel free. So, and remember, you can use the washrooms ad libertatem. So we're going to have a little process moment here. At some point, we're going to need to take a lunch break. I'm going to propose 1 o'clock. Is that okay? It's in about a half an hour. Does that sort of work? What sort of usual time is allocated here for that kind of thing? 75 minutes. Okay, that means an hour and 15 minutes. Is that correct? Does that work for people? Can we more or less do that? If you can't exactly do it, it's okay. But let's shoot for an hour and 15 minutes for lunch, which will take in about a half hour. And then we'll all come back here and we'll continue and complete our workshop, or today's component of the workshop. So what we're going to do now is take a moment for you to talk about your experiences just now, or raise any other questions or topics that you would like discussed that are relevant to this practice in any way whatsoever. So we'll, as I mentioned, the tenor of the day will be alternating periods of discussion with periods of practice. And let's go for a little discussion, then we'll have another brief practice and we'll transition to lunchtime. Yes. You guys don't have mics, so you sort of have to yell. Oh, you do have a mic. It circulates. Okay, great.
This is a two-part question. Can you distinguish between the resting state and dullness, what you called spaced out?
Okay.
And second of all, when you're not labeling, where does your attention resting? Is there an anchor?
You mean a place you intentionally come back to?
Right.
So good. Let's start with the first question. So what's the distinction between restful states and dullness? So this goes, I will typically answer questions a little bit broader than the question itself. I sort of like to give a big picture and then say, okay, your specific question falls within a certain subset of this bigger picture. So big picture wise, what we're dealing with here is a matter of definitions. In other words, there's actually no official thing called restful states. Restful states are just a term that I use in my formulation. So we want to make sure that what I'm going to be talking about is just a particular way that I have chosen to cut up the pie of experience. And other teachers can very legitimately decide to cut up the pie in a very different way. So within my system, which for lack of an official name, I just call basic mindfulness, within the basic mindfulness system, the restful states are defined by listing what they are. They're not abstractly defined. Here's an example of auditory rest. If you have a tangible sense of an absence of mental quiet, and you're actually listening to that absence of talk as a presence of noble silence within you, that's one form of auditory rest. Or maybe you can find a direction in space where there's no sound. Or maybe you're in an environment where there is no sound, ambient sound. I live on Lake Champlain. And in winter, there's no sound. It's just amazing, okay? Everybody's windows are closed and it's all buffered by snow. And I grew up in LA, a lot of time in downtown LA. Real contrast, right? So I can hear physical silence anytime I want. And it's a tangible sensory event that I'm tasting a concentration on that absence as a kind of presence. Feel rest is physical relaxation or emotional peace in your body. sea rest is the dark or bright in front of, behind your closed eyes, or an awareness of an absence of a mental image, or an intentional defocusing of your external gaze. Okay, I know this is complicated, but it makes it tangible. Here's a list of things that in this system are called restful states. Now, you're clear about the quality of rest, its location in space, and you have moment-by-moment sensory contact with it. Clearly, this is not dullness. This is making the shamatha components the object of the vipassana. And that's called vipassana jhana practice in some formulations. So the difference between dullness and restful states, is it clear enough? But once again, this is only within the formulation of one person's system. Someone, other teacher who chops things up a different way will legitimately give you a different answer. So in fact, the restful states are the antithesis of dullness, but they are my strategy for dealing with the problem of dullness. Because one form of the dullness is sleepiness. Well, that's another issue. Read my blog on sleepiness. But another form of dullness is, well, nothing much seems to be coming up. Well, I would claim when nothing much seems to be coming up, it's highly probable that three things are available. Your mental screen is blank, your head is doesn't have internal dialogue, and your body is physically relaxed. That's three sensory events. They're absences, okay, or they're attenuated, but that's the whole point in the jhanas. You attenuate the senses, and then you penetrate that attenuated sense to get insight into impermanence, no self, and suffering nature, etc. So I think that's probably sufficient on your first question. The second question, actually, maybe it's the answer to both questions.
Was it somewhat? Well, is there a intentional choice?
Oh, no, it's not. You're right. It's not the answer to the second question. Yes. Well, that's right. Very good. So with the, now, once again, as I always do, I'm going to answer in a very broad sense. These kinds of questions, it's very useful if you are aware what context are we talking about, okay? Meaning, the question is really, within the context of our current technique, is there something we're coming back to? Because I could give you other techniques within my system which would definitely have something you're coming back to as an anchor place. But with this particular technique, the answer is no. There's no particular place we're preferencing to come back to. This contrasts with one of the ways that mindfulness is done in the Burmese tradition. In the Mahasi tradition, some of the teachers, maybe most of the teachers, will actually have you have breath as default. You note whatever comes up, but if nothing much seems to be coming up, you default to the rising, falling of the abdomen. Completely legitimate technique, obviously. However, I don't have that, not with this one. There's no place to default, okay? Now, why? Well, we could go into that, but okay. I won't actually answer the question why. I will give you another question that answers the question why, okay? However, this other question is not taken from the mindfulness tradition. It's taken from Rinzai Zen, Japanese Zen. So I sometimes say that we mindfulness teachers say too much and the Zen teachers don't say enough. If you've done both, you appreciate this little Buddhist in-joke, okay? So this is going to be an example of not saying enough. It's going to be, if you're not familiar with the Zen way of training, it's, what's the phrase? WTF. In Zen, they train your intuition muscles. One way that they train your intuition muscles is by giving you these problems, these questions that are weird and don't seem to have an intellectual answer. And what are those called?
Koans,
exactly. So this is a sort of Zen koan, and it's a question, okay? But it's actually the answer to the question, why don't I, in this particular technique, give you a place to come back to? I will give you a place to come back to with other techniques. But with this one, here's the Zen story. So one of the great figures in Chinese Zen was Lin Ji. That's his Mandarin Chinese name, Linji, Lin Ji, rising in a falling tone in Northern Chinese. Japanese call him Rinzai, Vietnamese call him Lam De, and the Koreans call him Imje. Those are all the local pronunciations of that name. So one day Lin Ji got up to his Dharma podium, and he said, within this 5-foot-high body of yours, there is an authentic human being that has no fixed position. If you have not seen him yet, look! Look! An authentic human being that has no fixed position. That's why there's no place to come back to. Wu Wei Zhenren, anybody here speak Chinese, Mandarin? Wu Wei Zhenren. It's a pun in Chinese. Zhen means authentic, Ren means person. It's not gender specific. Wu means without, and Wei means position. So it could be, well, you're one of those Taoist immortals that were so pure you never took a position in the government, no matter how much the emperor asked you. That's a Wu Wei Zhenren, an authentic Taoist adept Zhenren who never took a government position, which is a whole thing in Chinese culture. Or it could mean this other thing. Okay, the true self, AKA no self, that never has a fixed position anywhere. So answer a question with a question, but I think you got it, dude. So good for you. I think we have one here.
Hi, I found that when I'm in like a relaxed state, my body can like fluctuate in temperature in like a very rapid way. And I wanted to ask about that because I feel like it's partially what you're talking about in terms of like feeling vibrations in the body, but I find the more relaxed I am, the more rapid the temperature changes. I don't know.
Well, certainly any change in any of the modalities is a manifestation of anicca, A-N-I-C-C-A, which is impermanence. It can easily happen as the result of practice that weird stuff comes up in our sensory experience. And it could be in any of the modalities, although typically it's in body. So you get like weird sensations, you know, it's like, why am I hot? Why am I cold? Why am I nauseous, you know, et cetera. And the general paradigm that I like to use is, well, we may not know what causes those perturbations, but we know what to do. Just be aware of them, that's your clarity piece, and accept them, and that's your equanimity piece, and that purifies consciousness. The changes in temperature could have something to do with the sympathetic versus parasympathetic nervous system that's involved in sweating or not sweating, you know, that kind of thing. There's different physiological hypotheses. I can tell you it's not an uncommon report. These temperature things, sometimes people just get hot, sometimes people just get cold, can alternate. Whatever the underlying physiological mechanism, We just basically say, well, just be aware of it and accept it, and that gets the job done. Good. Looks like we've, well, there's one close, approximately, right over around the corner. Yeah.
Hi, thank you. So you mentioned as important the kind of the moment of transition between the formal meditation and ordinary life. And I wanted to know if you could elaborate a little bit more on that, particularly like how I can make best use of that moment.
Yes.
You know, what I can focus on during that moment.
That's right. Well, actually, I just briefly touched on six items that if you can contact one or a combination thereof and sort of stay with that even as you're sort of talking and moving and walking, then that's a good thing. So the first three are sort of pleasant states that can happen as the result of meditation. Now, it's really important to realize that if you have pleasant things that occur because of practice, that's good, and yeah, it's a sort of a sign of progress, but it's really important to know that if you don't have pleasant things, or if you have the opposite of pleasant things, arise as a result of practice, that's definitely not a sign that you're not making progress, okay? That's really important, because if we say, hey, you know, you could have this, this, and this sort of cool stuff happen, then people read that as, oh, but that cool stuff isn't happening to me, or the opposite of that cool stuff is happening to me, therefore I'm not making progress. But so I think that's loud and clear. So the first one is tranquility. You're more settled physically, emotionally. The mind is maybe a little less active. So you may taste tranquility or restful states, however you want to put it. And you can sort of stay with that, and it doesn't have to evaporate just because you're flapping your lips and moving your arms, okay? So that's one. Another is energy. There can be more fluidity, vibration, chi, vitality. You recharged your body. So I take energy as fairly broad spectrum of things that could be going on. Makes a nice contrast with the tranquility. And you could sort of ride on that energy. Then there may be increase in emotional well-being. You're happier. You're more smiley on the face, more rosy in the chest. And if there's any spontaneous feel-good in the emotional domain, well, that doesn't have to evaporate just because we start to move around and so forth. So there's sort of like those three reward flavors that are related to the content of your experience. Increased tranquility, increase energy, perhaps in the sense of flow, or perhaps in the sense of I just recharged my batteries. Flow meaning vibratory, undulatory, like that kind of stuff. And then it's like I'm a little happier. Then there are the three fundamental tastes of mindfulness. Concentration has its own taste. I can't put it into words, but it's its own reward. Very important work was done at the University of Chicago decades ago by a man named Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. You'll remember that name and how to spell it. It's Hungarian. But anyway, Mike, as he's known to his friends, showed that concentration is intrinsically rewarding. Well, Buddhists and others have known that for a long time. But then there's a kind of heightened clarity. Your senses are brighter and clearer. That's a reward. And then there's the equanimity, which is an openness to experience. You may be able to taste that. That's the taste of purification. When you have pleasures and pains and you don't push and pull, you can actually sense that it's breaking up the blockages within you. That's the taste of equanimity. So you may be able to, since I define mindful awareness as concentration, power, sensory clarity, and equanimity working together, you may be able to taste tangibly one or more of those factors. And then that helps you carry that factor into daily life. So That's how I make tangible the transition. So my initial training was in Zen in Japan. And my very first teacher had been Zen trained. And he liked to do this thing of, he made you sit for an hour and you had to sit in full lotus. And oh my God, that was an eternity. But just before he'd hit the bell, he'd pop off with some really pithy Zen, zinger, okay? And it would really leave an impression in you because, it's like sort of Zen brainwashing, but it's good because it's like, Pavlov-wise, after that zinger, he's going to hit the bell and you can finally like break posture or whatever. So I'll never forget, I was about a month into the practice and I was starting to get a little taste of concentration at the end of that horrible period of counting my breath. And one day, just before he hit the bell, he goes, I'll say it in the original Japanese, Detari haitari suru zammai wa onto no zammai ja nai. It's a real Zen macho, okay? You just got to get it in the original language. Detari haitari suru zammai wa. Zammai is the Japanese word for samadhi. Samai became zammai, okay? So the samadhi that you go into and come out of, honto no zammai janai, that's not real samadhi. In other words, hey guys, the bell's about to ring. Stay in the same state you are. Yeah, we're going to get up. Yeah, we're going to talk about this or that. We're going to think, we're going to move, we're going to flap our lips. That doesn't mean that your meditative state has to evaporate. Because I used to have this thing of, oh, I can just barely get in this state, and now I have to leave it because I have to take care of business. And it took me the longest time to realize that you just start taking care of business. You throw caution to the wind, you just start flapping your lips and waving your arms, with the faith that it's going to self-organize. And there might be a little ineptness at first, but then it does. And that's, by the way, one of the main ways that Zen spontaneity that you may have heard of is trained. By not fixating a small self, by manifesting the authentic person that has no fixed this or that, by just moving and talking and even thinking without considering. And that's how the Zen bounce starts to channel through how you carry yourself in the world. And that's that. So excellent question.
Thank you so much.
So we got a few more and we'll have plenty of time after lunch. And by the way, I'm hanging around here during lunch, as are I think my facilitators. So we'll all be here, to schmooze. If we don't catch your question right now, we'll get it during lunch or after lunch in the front.
Thanks. My question is, I guess, from within the context of like a insight progress type framework. Is it better to just objectively observe moment by moment when it includes clinging or aversion, or to prevent the clinging by favoring equanimous sensations with the attention? So I guess, yeah.
This is not a small question. I mean, I'm not putting it down. It's, in fact, big questions are good questions. This question takes some disambiguation, okay? So first of all, once again, there are a lot of ways of formulating the same path. Unfortunately, it's inconvenient, actually. Talk about an inconvenient truth. Because, I mean, this teacher is going to say, hey, it's this way, and this teacher is going to say, hey, it's this way. And then you're going to encounter teachers like me that are going to say, hey, you know what, it's sort of both ways and also this other thing. It's like, okay, that's another WTF. I mean, what am I going to do with this? Okay. So let me just tell you how, within my own personal framework, I address that. So I take equanimity to be a relationship to sensory experience, as opposed to being a certain type of sensory experience. Okay? So if that's clear, you'll see that you can be very judgmental in your mind and have all sorts of physical and emotional stuff going on in your body and still have equanimity, because you're allowing those images to come and go. You're allowing that mental talk to come and go. Content-wise, and those body experiences. So content-wise, it's like judgment in the body and judgment in the mind and pleasant and unpleasant, highly valenced physical and emotional sensations in the body. Content-wise. But your relationship to it is you just let it all come and go without push and pull. So once we define equanimity not as a kind of experience, for example, a tranquility or an absence of certain kinds of thoughts, if we define equanimity as a relationship to experience rather than a certain type of experiential content, then some of the confusion goes away around this. You know what your job is. Even if the content is highly valenced in the body in terms of pleasant versus unpleasant, highly valenced means it's strongly pleasant, strongly unpleasant, that kind of thing. Or even if you've got judgments running in your mind, you can be non-judgmental about the judgmentalness. You can let it come and go without push and pull. So to deal with that issue of I prefer not to equate equanimity or the thing we're trying to get to in terms of a particular kind of experience, or more importantly, the absence of certain kinds of experience. So you could, is that clear? So the key insight here, the key takeaway message in this particular formulation is equanimity is a relationship to sensory experience. It's not a kind of sensory experience. And what is the relationship? Well, the relationship is a relationship of let it come and go without push and pull. Now, why this, I'm going to broaden the answer to your question a little bit, because there's another huge area of confusion comes up over and over and over again, which is, should I just sit here and observe these things, or should I go out and take action in my personal life and in society and in the world? That is a misleading formulation. It sounds like an either or question. Either I sit here and just observe this stuff, or I take care of business and take responsibility for my life and the planet. It's not an either or question. It's a both and. You train yourself to take responsibility while you're letting sensory events come and go without push and pull. Because actions in the world are objective events. What you see, hear, feel are sensory events. The detachment in this path, at least as I would state it, is with regards to the coming and going of sensory events. I don't think it's necessarily a good thing to be detached with regards to the coming and going of objective circumstances. In our life or in society or the world, I think we can take a stand. But taking a stand in the objective world does not in the slightest militate against being detached from the comings and goings of the sensory impact of the objective world. Those are different things. And the common accusation that Buddhism is a path of irresponsibility and withdrawal and detachment in a bad sense, I think is basically answered by what I just said. And so that's what I have to say about that. And now let's have a couple minutes of practice to cap things off. Once again, take a moment to stretch up and settle in. And once again, establish formal technique. With or without labels, see, hear, feel. Once again, there may be some tranquility, energy, or well-being, or some taste of concentration, clarity, equanimity. If any one or combo of those is present, then it doesn't have to vanish simply because we transition from formal practice to life.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.